getting off, I would ask myself, did I live fully today? Did I love? Did I matter? I've asked those questions of myself every night for over 20 years. The truth is, I don't always go to bed with a resounding yes to all three questions. I have bad days just like anyone else, but the nights that I can say yes to those questions when I feel clear and on track are the nights I sleep best. That simple practice has given me more clarity than anything else I've ever done in life. Today, I still wear a bracelet engraved with those three words. I don't need the bracelet. I don't need to continue asking the questions, but I do because it keeps me clear and on track. This is similar to the work I had to do with Kate. Her identity formation practices had stagnated. She hadn't thought about a better version of herself for a long time because she was already doing so well. So in one coaching session, I asked her to describe herself in various situations over her life over the past few weeks. Upon coming home, while playing with her kids, while making a presentation at work, during interactions with friends, while out on a date with Mike. Then I asked her to do it again, this time describing herself in those same situations as if she were an even better future version of herself. She began to realize that who she had been in the past several weeks was not who she really imagined herself being in the upcoming years. That should be a wake-up call for anyone. Next, I asked her to identify three aspirational words that would describe her future self. She came up with alive, playful, and grateful. None of her descriptions or words sounded like merely going through the motions, which was how she had felt recently. This activity was also simple but eye-opening for her. Sometimes it's the simple thought processes that help us reset our focus. Kate was generally confident, but the issue was she had stopped envisioning a future Kate to grow into. That's what was hurting her. No vision, no enthusiasm. So I had her put her three aspirational words into her phone as an alarm label that went off three times per day. This means that as Kate went about her day, an alarm would go off and she'd see her words on her phone to remind her who she was and could become. Now it's your turn. Number one, describe how you've perceived yourself in the following situations over the past several months. With your significant other, at work, with the kids or team, in social situations with strangers. Number two, now ask, is that who I really see myself being in the future? How would my future self look, feel, and behave differently in those situations? Number three, if you could describe yourself in just three aspirational words, words that would sum up who you are at your best in the future, what would those words be? Why are those words meaningful to you? Once you find your words, put them in your phone as an alarm label that goes off several times per day. Social. High performers also have clear intentions about how they want to treat other people. They have high situational awareness and social intelligence, which helps them succeed and lead. In every situation that matters, they know who they want to be and how they want to interact with others. If this sounds like common sense, let's find out whether it's common practice in your life. Before you went into your last meeting, did you think about how you wanted to interact with each person in the meeting? Before your last phone call, did you think about the tone you would choose to use with the other person? On your last night out with your partner or friends, did you set an intention for the energy you wanted to create? When you were dealing with that last conflict, did you think about your values and how you wanted to come across to the other person when you talked to them? Do you actively think about how to be a better listener, how to generate positive emotions with others, how you can be a good role model? Questions of this kind may help you look within and gauge your level of intention. I found that high performers also regularly ask themselves a few primary questions right before interacting with people. They ask questions like these. How can I be a good person or leader in this upcoming situation? What will the other person or persons need? What kind of mood and tone do I want to set? Here are more interesting findings. When asked to choose words that describe their best interactions with others, high performers most often responded with words such as thoughtful, appreciative, respectful, open, honest, empathetic, loving, caring, kind, present, and fair. When asked to choose three words that best define how they would like to be treated by others, high performers most valued being respected and appreciated. The issue of respect, specifically, comes up a lot in conversations with high performers. They want to be respected, and they want to demonstrate respect with others. And this matters to them in all areas of their life, including at home. A field study of 200 couples in the United States who were married 40 years or longer and still reported being happy found that the couple's number one value and strength was respect. The four worst behaviors that lead to divorce, criticalness, defensiveness, contempt, and stonewalling, often feel so offensive precisely because they smack of devaluing or disrespect. What is apparent across all high performers is that they anticipate positive social interactions and they strive consciously and consistently to create them. It's a universal finding. When it comes to their interactions with others, they don't just go on autopilot. They're intentional, and that improves their performance. In looking to the future, it's clear they've thought about the big picture of their social life, too. They've thought about how they want to be remembered. They think about their character and legacy. High performers are looking out there beyond today, beyond the meeting, beyond the month's to-dos and obligations. They're consistently wondering, how do I want those I love and serve to remember me? Working with Kate, it was always clear that she tremendously valued and loved her family, yet she sensed she was often juggling so many things that she wasn't as present with them as she wanted to be. She once said, "I feel they deserve more from me, but I don't know if I have that much more to give." Do you know what the issue with that is? When you are constantly juggling and feeling depleted, you don't think about the future. You're just trying to survive today, and so you start to lose your clear intention for your interactions with your family and teams tomorrow. This is a common struggle with achievers. They want to be better lovers and parents, but feel stretched too thin. Their mistake is the same one Kate was making. She kept thinking that more time was what she needed to be a good mom or wife. One day, she thought, I'll finally get to be the mom I want to be with my kids and the wife I hope to be. But you and I both know that one day really means never. To help Kate change and improve her relationships, I had her imagine in advance her interactions with people and then live into those intentions each day. She didn't need more time or to wait one more day. It wasn't about quantity. It was about quality. So I asked Kate to try this activity, which I recommend you try too. A, write down each person's name in your immediate family and team. B, imagine that in 20 years, each person is describing why they love and respect you. If each person could say just three words to summarize the interactions they had with you in life, what would you want those three words to be? C, next time you're with each of those people, approach your time with them as an opportunity to demonstrate those three qualities. Have those words as the goal and start living into those qualities. Challenge yourself to be that person now. This will bring life back into your relationships. I said it to Kate all the time. It's almost impossible just to go through the motions when you have clear and compelling intentions. Skills. Next, we found that high performers are very clear about the skill sets they need to develop now to win in the future. They don't draw a blank when you ask them, what three skills are you currently working to develop so you'll be more successful next year? When I'm brought into work with Fortune 500 senior executives, I have them open their calendars and talk me through their upcoming days, weeks, and months. It turns out that executives who score higher on the HPI, that's the high performance indicator, tend to have more blocks of time already scheduled for learning than do their peers with lower scores. There's an hour blocked out here for taking an online training, another there for executive coaching, another for reading, and yet another for a mastery-oriented hobby like piano, language learning, cooking class, and so on. They've built a curriculum for themselves and are actively engaged in learning. What's clearly linking all these blocks of scheduled time is a desire to develop specific skill sets. The online training is about how to code or manage finances better. The executive coaching is focused on developing listening skills. The reading focuses on a specific skill they've been trying to master, such as strategy, listening in meetings, or story development. The hobby is something they take seriously. They aren't just doing it for pleasure, per se, but to actively develop mastery. Here's the big distinction. High performers are also working on skills that focus on what I call their primary field of interest, which we abbreviate as PFI. They aren't scattershot learners. They've homed in on their passionate interests, and they set up activities or routines to develop skill in those areas. If they love music, they laser in on what kind of music they want to learn, and they study it. Their PFI is specific. They don't just say music and then try to learn all forms of music, playing guitar, joining an orchestra, singing with the band. They choose, say, a 5-string guitar, find a master teacher, and make time for practice sessions that focus more on skill building than on casual exploration. In other words, they know their passions and set up time to dial in the skills that will turn those passions into proficiencies. This means high performers approach their learning not as generalists, but as specialists. Since by now you have some familiarity with my work, I'll use my career as an example. I began as a change management analyst for a global consulting company. I was right out of grad school. In my first 6 months on the job, I approached my work the way most of my peers did, as a generalist. I was trying to learn everything about the company, my clients, the world. That's what you do when you're a novice. But soon, I realized that many of my partners had specific areas of expertise. And if I was going to stand out among the other 80,000-plus employees, I'd better develop a skill set fast. So I chose leadership, which was also my area of focus in grad school. Specifically, I wanted to develop the skill of knowing how to build curriculum for leaders and their teams. Leadership was my PFI. That stands for primary field of interest. Curriculum building was the skill. I requested or created relevant projects. My career skyrocketed. When I left corporate America to become a full-time writer and trainer, I made similar decisions. I made my PFI personal development, but so had many thousands of other writers, bloggers, speakers, and trainers. How would I stand out? I realized that the skill most of these folks lacked wasn't related to their topic, but rather to their marketing of the topic. I was in the same boat. Personal development was always a passion, and I already spent most of my personal reading time studying psychology, neuroscience, sociology, and behavioral economics. I was fascinated by those subjects, so I didn't need more focus there. I needed more focus on building my brand. So I made a huge shift. I made marketing my PFI. This was a monumental decision for me because I had absolutely no talent, skills, strengths, or background in marketing. But I recognized it as the key that would unlock the door to my success in my new career. So I started drilling down into skill sets. I didn't focus on every skill related to marketing as a generalist would do, just as I hadn't focused on everything related to leadership in general at my corporate gig. Instead, I zeroed in on email marketing and video production. I took online courses on these topics, and I went to seminars. I hired a coach. My calendar was full of building those two skills. For 18 months, I focused almost exclusively on learning and trying new things related to email marketing and making videos. Specifically, I learned to capture emails and send those subscribers weekly newsletters that linked to a featured video training on my blog. I also learned how to put all my videos in an online members area and charge people money to access them. 18 months later, I found I had succeeded as an early pioneer in online education. Thousands of people were signing up for my online courses, some of which cost over $1,000. Many people in my industry thought it was some sort of magic act or assumed that I was some kind of online genius. But neither was true. I had simply looked to the future, identified what it would take to win in the industry in coming years, and then realigned my activities to develop the skills I needed to succeed. The lesson was simple but powerful. Look to the future. Identify key skills. Obsessively develop those skills. This sounds easy, but in a world where we are so distracted and reactive, it has become a lost art. We just forget to develop our own curriculum in life, even those of us at the highest levels. I remember I once had the blessing of being brought in to speak to Oprah and her executive team. The aha moment was this idea that high performers build their own curriculum. I remember being surprised that after I finished the training, of all the things I said, the team posted this one quote from me to summarize our session. If you leave your growth to randomness, you'll always live in the land of mediocrity. I hope the takeaway is clear. No matter your current level of performance, clarifying your PFI and skills you need to master for your next level of success must be a priority. Reconnecting with your passion and setting up structure to develop more skills related to it is a game changer. It's just one thing Kate did to burst through her feelings of just going through the motions. We spent time talking about what it was going to take to win in her PFI in the next 10 years and realized she could learn new skills related to her industry. After she signed up for a few courses and found a mentor at work to help her learn more, she sent me this email. Amazingly, at some point in my career, I got so good at what I was doing that I forgot how much I really loved to learn. I took my eyes off what I needed to learn in the future. But today, I finished an online course, and I can't describe how accomplished that simple act made me feel. It was like graduating from high school all over again. That kind of optimism for the future came back into my life because learning opens the mind and begs it to play. I can't believe changing how I feel was as easy as choosing to learn again. You can follow Kate's lead. Try this. Number one, think of your PFI, primary field of interest, and write down three skills that make people successful in that field. Number two, under each skill, write down what you will do to develop it. Will you read, practice, get a coach, go to a training? When? Set up a plan to develop those skills, put it in your calendar, and stay consistent. Number three, now think about your PFI and write down three skills that you will need in order to succeed in that field 5 to 10 years from now. In other words, try to imagine the future. What new skill sets will you likely need then? Keep those skills on your radar and start developing them sooner rather than later. Service. It had been too long since Kate felt the difference she was making. She had lost the spirit of service to others, and that's what had caused her to start merely going through the motions at work. Though nothing there had changed, she began perceiving her days as a series of empty tasks. Specifically, while she was a phenomenal leader at work, and she truly felt the spirit of service in leading her teams, she had lost connection to those ultimately affected by their work, her customers. It turned out that Kate hadn't actually spoken with any of her customers in years. She had become an internal executive in a big company, far removed from the front lines, and the real people that her organization served. So she started a monthly practice of visiting her customers and really listening to them and asking what they wanted from her company in the future. Soon, her enthusiasm for work came roaring back. The last of the four futures, after self, social, and skills, concerns how high performers look to tomorrow and consider their service to the world. Specifically, high performers care deeply about the difference they're going to make for others and in the future in general, so they cater today's activities to delivering those contributions with heart and elegance. This might sound like a broad description, but it's how high performers talk. They often speak of how all the extra efforts they make to wow people today are vitally important to leaving a lasting legacy tomorrow. That's why, for high performers, the details of how they treat others or approach their work truly matter. The high-performing waiter obsesses whether the table is set with symmetry and precision, not just because it's his job, but because he cares about the overall customer experience and how the restaurant will be perceived now and in the future. The extraordinary product designer obsesses about style, fit, and function, not just to create strong sales through this season, but also to create devoted fans and to serve a larger brand vision. What ties all these things together is the future focus conveyed in this question. How can I serve people with excellence and make an extraordinary contribution to the world? The opposite is easy to spot. When someone becomes disconnected from the future and their contribution to it, they underperform. They have nothing to get excited about tomorrow, so they stop caring about the details today. That is why it's so vital that leaders continually engage their people in conversations about tomorrow. What will provide the most value to those you serve? This is a question high performers obsess about, and I don't use the word obsess lightly. In our interviews, we found that high performers give an extraordinary amount of thought to questions of service, how to add value, inspire those around them, and make a difference. Their attention in this area could be best described as a search for relevance, differentiation, and excellence. Relevance has to do with eliminating things that don't matter anymore. High performers don't live in the past, and they don't keep pet projects at the forefront. They ask, what matters now, and how can I deliver it? Differentiation allows high performers to look at their industry, their career, and even their relationships for what makes them unique. They want to stand out for who they are and to add more value than others do. Excellence comes from an internal standard that asks, how can I deliver beyond what's expected? For high performers, the question, how can I serve with excellence, gets more attention than perhaps any other. In stark contrast again, underperformers are too focused on self over service. They give more mindshare to what do I want now than to what do those I serve want now. They ask, how can I get by with the least amount of effort, instead of how can I serve with excellence? Underperformers ask, why don't people recognize my unique strengths? While high performers are asking, how can I serve in unique ways? At the end of this chapter, you'll get a worksheet tying together all the ideas of the future four. For now, let me introduce you to a section that will conclude each of the practices in this book, called performance prompts. These prompts are sentence completion activities that will help you reflect further on the important concepts you're learning. I highly recommend you write out and complete each of these statements in a separate journal. If you would like a companion workbook with all the prompts included and more space for reflection, visit highperformancehabits.com/tools. That's highperformancehabits.com/tools. Whether you use the worksheet or just grab a journal of your own and freeform your thoughts, I suggest you sit and write out what you want of life. No goals, no growth, no clarity, no change. Performance prompts. These are the sentences you should complete. Number one, when I think about the future for self, social, skill, and service, the area that I haven't had as much intention in as I should is... Number two, the areas in which I have not been considering those I serve and lead are... Number three, to leave a lasting legacy, the contributions I can start making now are... Practice two, determine the feeling you're after. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. Howard Thurman. The second practice that will help you heighten and sustain clarity in your life is to ask yourself frequently, what is the primary feeling I want to bring to this situation? And what is the primary feeling I want to get from this situation? Most people are terrible at this. Underperformers especially are neglectful of the kinds of feelings they are experiencing or want to experience in life. They bumble into situations and allow those situations to define how they feel. This explains why they have low self-awareness and weak self-control. High performers demonstrate a tremendous degree of emotional intelligence and what I call willful feeling. In performance situations, they can accurately describe their emotions, but more importantly, they can also calibrate the meaning they draw from those emotions and determine the feelings they want to endure. Let me give you an example. I worked with an Olympic sprinter who was at the top of his game that year. But in prior years, his performance was often erratic. Sometimes he won a competition, other times he didn't even make the qualifying cut. When I got the call to work with him, he had a year-long winning streak. In our first session together, I asked, if you had to describe why you're winning now, in just three words, what would they be? He said, feeling, feeling, feeling. When I asked him to explain, he said, I got very clear about the feelings I needed in my mind and my body before I walked out onto the field. While I readied myself at the starting blocks, what I sensed in the middle of the sprint, and what I wanted to feel after I crossed the line, and even all the way back into the tunnel. I asked if that meant he got control of his emotions and didn't experience performance anxiety anymore. He laughed. No, when I'm at the starting blocks, my body still senses the energy and emotion of it all. My body is naturally aware of what's at stake, and there's an emotion of some fear that's there no matter what. But I don't feel anxious. I define the feeling. I tell myself what I'm sensing is a feeling of readiness, excitement. I've heard so many high performers describe this practice in some form or another. They can sense their emotional state in any given moment, but they often choose to override it by defining what they want to feel. Let's pause to differentiate between emotions and feelings. While researchers differ in their definitions of what an emotion is, many agree that emotions are different from feelings. Emotions are generally instinctive, a triggering event, which can be an external situation or simply our brain anticipating something, generates an emotional response like fear, amusement, sadness, anger, relief, or love. Often, the emotional response happens without much of our conscious will. We just suddenly feel the emotion because our brain interpreted something happening and attached a meaning and emotion to it, guided mostly from how we sensed the situation from the past. This doesn't mean that we are conscious of all our emotions or that we can't also generate an emotion consciously. For example, seeing your baby smile at you may stir joy in your heart, but you could also elicit the emotion of joy simply by purposely thinking about the same incident later on without the actual stimulus. Still, the vast majority of the emotions we feel in life are automatic and physical. The word feeling here is used to refer to a mental portrayal of an emotion. This is not a precise statement, but it's helpful for our purposes here. Think of an emotion as mostly a reaction, and feeling is an interpretation. Like the sprinter, the emotion of fear came up, but you don't have to choose to feel frightened and run away. You can experience the sudden emotion of fear, but in the very next moment choose to feel centered. Whenever you calm yourself down, you are choosing a different feeling than the emotion that may have come up for you. Before entering any performance situation, high performers contemplate how they want to feel regardless of what emotions might come up, and they envision how they want to feel leaving the situation regardless of what emotions might come up. Then they exert self-control to achieve those intentions. Here's another example that shows this dynamic at play. If I'm in a meeting and people suddenly start arguing with a negative tone, I'll probably experience immediate emotions like fear, anger, or sadness. The response is pretty predictable. My heart will start pounding, my hands will get sweaty, my breathing will get shallow. Those emotions can soon evoke feelings of dread or anxiety. Knowing this, I can choose to feel differently in the meeting even if those emotions come up instinctively. I can tell myself that the emotions are just telling me to pay attention or to speak up for myself or to feel empathetic toward others. Instead of allowing the emotion to evoke the feeling of dread, I can just let it be, take a few deep breaths, and choose to feel alert, yet calm. I can keep breathing deeply, speak in an even tone, sit comfortably in my chair, think positively about the people in the room, choose to be a calm force amid the storm. All these choices generate a feeling that's different from what came up earlier. My automatic emotions don't have to be in charge. My feelings are my own. Over time, if I choose to create the feelings I want from my emotions, my brain will likely habituate to the new feelings. Fear suddenly doesn't feel so bad anymore because my brain has learned that I'll deal with it well. My old references for how I feel after the emotion has changed, and that can change the actual automatic emotion's power. The emotion of fear still might get triggered, but now the feeling I sense from it is what I've created in the past. Emotions come and go. They're mostly immediate, instinctive, and physical. But feelings last, and they're often a result of rumination, which you have control over. Anger can be the emotion that comes up, but bitterness, a lasting feeling, doesn't have to be your lifelong sentence. This might sound as if I'm just parsing words, and again, I acknowledge that my descriptions are imprecise. No description of any function of mind or body can be precise because there is always variance and no thought or emotion is an island. Our senses and intentions interact and overlap across a vast neural network. But I share this here because it's so thoroughly obvious that high performers are generating the feelings they want more often than taking the emotions that land on them. When high-performing athletes say they are trying to get in the zone, what they mean is that they're trying to use their conscious attention to narrow their focus and feel in the zone. Being in the zone is not an emotion that just happens. Athletes will themselves there by minimizing distractions and immersing themselves in what they are doing. For high-level athletes and high performers from all walks of life, flow is a feeling they choose. It is summoned, not a lucky emotion that conveniently happens to show up just in time for kickoff. It's when we stop being conscious of our feelings that we get in trouble. Then the negativity of the world can start stirring negative emotions, which, if we don't control the meaning of, can evoke long-term negative feelings, which in turn set the stage for a horrible life. But if we seek to experience life and all its emotions and yet choose to feel centered, happy, strong, and loving right through the ups and downs, then we've accomplished something powerful. We've wielded the power of willful feeling, and suddenly life feels the way we want it to. That's what Kate had been forgetting. She was too lost in a sea of unpredictable emotions. She wasn't choosing to feel any one way over another. She wasn't aware of how she was treating the emotions and experiences, and so she just became reactive. She wasn't just going through the motions, she was going through the emotions, so she wasn't really feeling life the way she wanted to anymore. All I had to do was get her to choose how she wanted to feel in each situation she entered, and that intention and activity alone brought more vibrancy and color back into her life. In your everyday life, start asking, what do I want to feel today? How could I define the meaning of the day so that I feel what I want to? Next time you go on a date with someone, think about the feelings you want to create. Before you sit down with your child to work on math, ask, what do I want to feel when I'm helping my kid? What feelings do I want them to have about me, about homework, about their life? This kind of clarity and intention will change how you experience life. Performance prompts. Number one, the emotions I've been experiencing a lot of lately are... Number two, the areas of life where I'm not having the feelings I want to are... Number three, the feelings I want to experience more of in life include... Number four, the next time I feel a negative emotion come up, the first thing I'm going to say to myself is... Practice 3. Define what's meaningful. unhappiness is not knowing what we want and killing ourselves to get it. Don Harold. High performers can do almost anything they set their heart and mind to, but not every mountain is worth the climb. What differentiates high performers from others is their critical eye in figuring out what is going to be meaningful to their life experience. They spend more time doing things that they find meaningful, and this makes them happy. It's not want of strength that locks us into unlived lives. Rather, it is lack of a decisive cause, something worth striving for, an ambitious purpose that sets our hearts ablaze and our feet marching forward. Our striving for a meaningful life is one of the main factors associated with psychological well-being. But what do we mean by meaning? When most people talk about having meaning at work, they typically discuss A, enjoyment of the tasks of work, B, alignment of personal values with the work, and C, fulfillment from the outcomes of the work. When researchers try to identify what is meaningful to people, they often focus on how important you say an activity is to you, how much time you spend at it, how committed you are, how attached to it you are, and whether you would do the work despite low compensation. They try to figure out whether you see the work as just a job or an important career or calling. They often associate a clear sense of purpose with an overall sense of meaning in life. Do high performers approach meaning the same way? We randomly selected 1,300 individuals who scored in the top 15% on the HPI and asked them questions such as, how do you know when you're doing something meaningful? What does it feel like? If you had to choose between two good projects, how would you go about choosing the one that would be most meaningful to you? How do you know when you're doing something that isn't bringing meaning into your life? At the end of your life, how would you know whether you had lived a meaningful life? Since the questions were open-ended, we combed through the responses looking for patterns. What emerged was that high performers tended to equate four factors with meaning. First, they linked enthusiasm with meaning. When forced to choose between two projects, for example, many mentioned they would do the one they could be most enthusiastic about. This finding dovetails with research findings that enthusiasm independently predicted life satisfaction, positive emotions, fewer negative emotions, environmental mastery, personal growth, positive relations, self-acceptance, purpose in life, engagement, positive relationships, meaning, and achievement. Clearly, if you want a positive life, you would do well to summon as much enthusiasm as possible. It was these feelings that inspired me to ask myself this question every morning in the shower. What can I get excited or enthusiastic about today? That simple question has changed the way I walk into each day. Try it. The second link to meaning was connection. People who become socially isolated report that their life has lost meaning. Social relationships, especially with those closest to us, are the most frequently reported sources of meaning in life. Like everyone else, high performers value the relationships they have in life and work. What's unique about high performers, though, is that connection often correlates with meaning, especially at work. Connection is less about comfort than about challenge. In other words, high performers feel that their work has more meaning when they are in a peer group that challenges them. In their everyday life, too, they value being around inspiring people who push them to grow more than, say, people who are just fun to be around or are generally kind. Third, high performers relate satisfaction with meaning. If what they are doing creates a sense of personal satisfaction, they feel that their life is more meaningful. Teasing out what satisfaction means to people is as difficult as finding out how they define meaningful. But for high performers, there is a clear equation for what leads to personal satisfaction. When your efforts correspond with one of your primary passions, lead to personal or professional growth, and make a clear and positive contribution to others, you tend to call those efforts satisfying. There's a formula in the book on page 86, and it's this one. Passion plus growth plus contribution equals personal satisfaction. Other researchers have found that security, autonomy, and balance can also be important to satisfaction, especially on the job. The fourth way that high performers say their efforts have meaning is by making them feel that their life makes sense. Psychologists call this coherence. It means that the story of your life or of the recent events in your life is comprehensible to you in some way. This sense of coherence seems to be particularly important to high performers. They want to know that their efforts align with something important, that their work is significant, and that their lives are creating a legacy and feeding a larger purpose. Often the desire for things to make sense is more important to a high performer than our autonomy and balance. They will put their own desires for control or work-life balance aside if they sense that what they are doing makes sense and adds to a greater whole. Certainly, more research needs to be done on how high performers view meaning. The research my team and I have conducted gives us a good start, though. You may find this simple equation helpful. Enthusiasm plus connection plus satisfaction plus coherence equals meaning. Again, that's enthusiasm plus connection plus satisfaction plus coherence equals meaning. Not all these factors need to be in play at once to give us a sense of meaning. Sometimes just watching your child walk across a room can do it, or finishing that important report. A lovely date night or hosting a mentoring lunch can make life meaningful. The important thing is this. You need to bring more conscious and consistent thought to what you will find meaningful in life. You start by exploring your own definitions of meaning and how to enhance it in your life. When you learn the difference between busy work and your life's work, that's the first step on the path of purpose. Performance prompts. Number one, the activities that I currently do that bring me the most meaning are. Number two, the activities or projects that I should stop doing because they are not bringing me any sense of meaning are. Number three, if I was going to add new activities that bring me more meaning, the first ones I would add would be. Putting it all together. The meaning of life is whatever you ascribe to it. Joseph Campbell. You have to have a vision for yourself in the future. You have to discern how you want to feel and what will be meaningful to you. Without those practices, you have nothing to dream of and strive for. No pop and zest in your daily life propelling you forward. We've covered a lot in this chapter. How do we put all these practices together so that our practices for clarity are strong and consistent? I recommend the same thing I did for Kate, who felt that she was just going through the motions in her work, her relationships, and her life. You'll recall that she was so good, she didn't really need to try anymore. She forgot to look to the future and have strong intentions, which led her to being busy but unfulfilled. It led her to feeling lost. To help her reorient herself, I had her begin a simple habit of contemplation that would hit all the practices you've learned in this chapter. I gave Kate a tool called the Clarity Chart. It's a one-page journal sheet that I asked her to fill out every Sunday evening for 12 weeks. You can find the short version in the book, and you can download the full-page version at highperformancehabits.com/tools. That's highperformancehabits.com/tools. Of course, you don't need to fill out the chart every week. You don't have to do anything I'm suggesting. But I promise that this activity will help you, even if your responses don't change much from week to week. High performance clarity happens because we put these concepts up onto the dashboard of our conscious mind. Perhaps you've given occasional thought to the concepts we've discovered in this chapter. But our goal is to focus on these things more consistently than you ever have before. That's what moves the needle. With greater focus will come greater clarity, and with greater clarity will come more consistent action and ultimately high performance. The Clarity Chart. Download a printable weekly version at highperformancehabits.com/tools. In the book, it's on page 95. And on page 95, you'll see a chart with six boxes. One box says self, another says social, another says skills, another says service. the very things we covered in practice one, self, social, skills, and service. Practice two, you'll see a box for focusing on the feeling. Practice three, you'll see a box for defining what's meaningful. Again, you can get this chart at highperformancehabits.com/tools. High performance habit number two, generate energy. The world belongs to the energetic. Ralph Waldo Emerson. Three practices of this chapter, release tension, set intention, bring the joy, optimize health. If I keep up this pace, I'll eventually burn out or probably just die. Arun laughs and shifts uncomfortably in his chair. Then all this was for nothing. He looks as though he's barely slept in months. His face sags. His eyes are red, the sparkle inside gone. He doesn't have the vibrant charge like he did on the cover of that business magazine last year. I feign a look of surprise. Die, huh? When do you think that eventually might happen? Are you talking next week, this year, next year? I'm not sure, but don't tell anyone. It's brave of him to be telling me this. No one likes to admit they've been working themselves into the ground. Especially here in Silicon Valley, it's a badge of honor to work nonstop. There are a lot of young, smart workaholics here on this peninsula, pumped up on excessive caffeine and become a billionaire in a few years dreams. 6 hours ago, a friend called and asked me if he could conference in Arun to introduce us. We exchanged pleasantries, and 2 hours later, Arun's private jet arrived to pick me up. Now I'm sitting in a glass conference room in his office near San Francisco. It's 3 a.m., and we're the only ones in the building. Some achievers won't let their guard down until after midnight. I'm not entirely sure why he's flown me here. On the phone, he just said it was urgent, and he thought I could help. I'd wanted to meet him someday anyway, so I agreed. So what's up, I say. I'm guessing you didn't fly me here to play mom and tell you to get more sleep. He laughs and pulls back in his chair. No, that's not it. I know I need more rest. And yet, you don't get more rest. I will. I've heard this before, the someday I'll take better care of myself story. Right now, I just have to hustle, they all say, to build, to take over the world. Well, that's not true, Arun, and that's okay. The truth is, you won't flame out. You'll keep working hard at an insane pace, just as you've done for the past 15 years. You won't burn out. You'll just become utterly, tragically miserable. You'll wake up one day even richer and more accomplished than you are now, and life just won't feel the way you wanted it to. But you will make a bad and abrupt decision. You'll quit or you'll fail. You'll realize your mind and body didn't let you down. Your choices did. But I'm guessing you already know that. Yeah, he says, then rolls back his left shirt sleeve. He points to a needle mark. Don't freak out. It's not drugs. I'm doing that Myers cocktail thing, bunch of B vitamins and stuff. It's probably not helping, you know? I don't show a reaction. I've seen them all by now. All the quick fixes and prescriptions and fads people use in a desperate grab to revitalize their lives. When people want the edge, often the first place they look is outside themselves. So what would help, Arun? You're a smart guy. You probably already know the answers. So with respect, I don't want to waste your time. It's 3 a.m. Why am I here? I want to feel good again. I don't want the emotional roller coaster anymore. I don't want to be tired. There has to be a way to crush it and still be happy. People say it's possible, but in 40 years, I haven't figured it out. That's for sure. But I know you can help. And how do you know that? Arun rolls up the sleeve on his other arm. He holds up his wrist and shows me a leather bracelet, engraved with one of my quotes. He jabs at it with his finger. I want this again, man. Where'd you get that? My wife. It's embarrassing, but I'll tell you, we're having issues. She went to your event. She's a different person now. She said she bought this for me because I needed it, because we needed it. Was she right? He sighs and joins me standing, looking out into his offices. I can't take us. I can't take everyone here higher when I feel so low. My energy is dipping. The team can sense it. I'm not happy, and I don't want to feel this way anymore. The engraving on the leather bracelet reads, "Bring the joy." Energy basics. Energy is eternal delight. William Blake. As you might expect, it takes a lot of energy to succeed over the long haul. High performers have the magical trifecta of capital E energy, that holistic kind that includes positive and enduring mental, physical, and emotional vibrancy. It's the key force that helps them perform better in many areas of their life. It's why high performers have so much more passion, stamina, and motivation. If you can tap into the capital E energy stored within, the world is yours. In our high performance research, we measure energy by asking people to rate themselves on a scale of 1 through 5 on statements such as this: I have the mental stamina to be present and focused throughout the day. I have the energy I need to achieve my goals every day. In general, I feel cheerful and optimistic. We also reverse score with statements like this: my mind feels slow and foggy. I am physically exhausted too often. I feel a lot of negative energy and emotions. You'll notice that energy isn't just physical, which is how most people conceive of it. Mental alertness matters too. So does positive emotion. In fact, all three have been correlated with high performance. When I use the word energy in this audiobook, then, keep in mind it means the full spectrum of mental, emotional, and physical vibrancy. The headline from our research on this topic may seem obvious to you. Low energy correlates with lower overall high performance scores. But the details of the findings should get your attention. The lower your ratings in energy, the lower your overall happiness. The lower your enthusiasm for taking on challenges. The lower your perception of your own success versus your peers. The lower your confidence in the face of adversity. The lower the degree of influence you'll have with others. And the lower the likelihood that you'll eat well or exercise. So low energy not only hurts your ability to reach high performance overall, it pervades all aspects of your life. You feel less happy. You don't take on the big challenges. You feel as if everyone is passing you by. Your confidence tanks. You eat worse. You get fatter. You struggle to get people to believe in you, buy from you, follow you, support you. But of course, the flip side also applies. Increase your energy and you improve all those factors. And there's more. Energy is also positively correlated to educational attainment, creativity, and assertiveness. This tends to mean that the more energy someone has, the more likely they are to pursue higher levels of education, to come up with creative ideas at work, and to speak up for themselves and take action toward their dreams. That's why organizations and academic institutions worldwide should get very serious about developing employee and student energy scores. Regarding job roles, CEOs and senior executives have the highest energy, significantly higher than those in other roles we've measured, such as managers, entry-level workers, students, interns, and caregivers. This holds true even when we control for age. In a stunning finding, CEOs and senior executives have energy equivalent to that of professional athletes. It turns out that to make it to CEO, you have to care about your energy as much as an NFL quarterback does, because it takes about the same level of energy. Bottom line, the more energy someone has, the more likely they are to be happy and climb to the top of their primary field of interest. It turns out, too, that marriage is good for your energy, just as it's good for your longevity. In our surveys, married people have more energy than their never-married counterparts. So go ahead and tell any fearful friends that their belief that marriage makes you dull, tired, or moody just doesn't hold up. Finally, energy is significantly related to productivity. If you ever want to get more done, you don't need to buy some new app or organize your papers better. It's less about doing email better and more about doing energy better. My personal experience coaching extraordinary people validates the data and then some. Often, I see people forget to focus on their energy as they build their career, and then disaster strikes. I've seen low energy destroy marriages, turn kind people into stress monsters, and wipe out years of several companies' financial gains in just months after its CEO burns out. Almost all modern health research confirms the importance of our well-being, which is the term often used to describe a more holistic sense of energy. Unfortunately, we don't do well at taking care of our well-being. More than one-third of Americans are obese, costing the United States over $147 billion per year in medical expenses. Only about 20% of Americans get even the minimum aerobic and muscle-strengthening activity recommended by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC. Other studies reveal that 42% of American adults say they aren't doing enough to manage their stress. 20% say they never do any activities to relieve or manage their stress. And 1 in 5 say they have no one to rely on for emotional support. 1 in 3 working Americans is chronically stressed on the job, and fewer than half say their organizations support employee well-being. This, even though companies that promote their employees' well-being are more productive, bear lower healthcare costs, retain their people longer, and see their people make better decisions. Stress is the ultimate energy and well-being killer. It slows the production of new brain cells, reduces serotonin and dopamine, which are critical to your mood, and fires up your amygdala while simultaneously decreasing your hippocampus function, making you a frazzled person with decreased memory. We could devote several books to the subject of well-being and hardly scratch the surface, but I want to zero in on energy measures as described at the beginning of this chapter and see just how they correlate with individual high performance. The good news is, you can dramatically increase your energy and overall performance with just a few simple practices. Your energy is not a fixed mental, physical, or emotional state. Again, you don't have energy any more than a power plant does. A power plant transforms and transmits energy. In the same regard, you don't have happiness. Rather, you transform your thoughts into feelings that are or are not happy. You don't have to have sadness. You can transform it to something else. This means you don't have to wait for joy, motivation, love, excitement, or any other positive emotion in life. You can choose to generate it on demand anytime you want through the power of habit. Like any other area of your life or any other set of skills, it can be improved. Here are the 3 big practices I've seen high performers leverage to maintain their edge and their energy. Practice 1. Release tension, set intention. Human excellence is a state of mind. Socrates. In a decade of coaching high performers, I found that the easiest, fastest, and most effective way to help them increase their energy is to teach them to master transitions. Every day, people lose tremendous amounts of focus, will, and emotional energy by managing transitions poorly. They also lose the benefit of greater mental and physical stamina throughout the day. What do I mean by transitions? Well, every morning when you wake up and start your day, you experience a transition from rest to activation. The start of your day is a transition. The time you drop off the kids and start your commute, that's a transition from family time to drive time. When you finish your commute to work, open your car door and walk into the office, that's a transition from solitary time to working with others. At work, when you finish creating that presentation and now go to check email, that's a transition. You're going from creative mode to email mode. When a meeting ends and you walk back to your desk, sit down, and jump on a conference call, that's a transition. The workday ends, you hop back into the car and head to the gym. 2 more transitions. Pull up to your house after a long day and walk into your home and become mommy or daddy? Transition. You get the idea. Our days comprise a series of transitions. These transitions are immensely valuable, a powerful space of freedom between activities. And it's in this space that you'll discover your greatest restorer and amplifier of energy. Think about all the transitions you experience during the day. Take a moment and just think about a few of them now. Now let me ask you a few questions about these transitions. Do you ever carry any negative energy from one activity to the next? Do you ever feel depleted but still plow into your next activity without a break, even though you know you should take a breather? Are you losing a sense of presence and appreciation for life and others the further you go in your day? Most people answer yes to all 3 questions. I'm convinced that if we can get you to change the way you shift from one activity to the next, we can revitalize your life. So, are you ready for an experiment? From now on, as you move from one major activity to another, try this. 1. Close your eyes for the next minute or two.